Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking all things tech on the show today. And to start, we're going to be talking about something called a digital wallet. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Beth Wendt back with us. She's a senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. She brings 20 years of experience and a love for creative problem solving. So it's great to have her back to talk about, well, digital payment apps like Venmo and the latest in the world of cryptocurrency. I see we already have a cryptocurrency question coming up on the phone, so we'll be looking forward to hearing from Steve about that. But what about your experience? What's it been with digital payment methods? What questions do you have about setting that up? What are you wondering about cryptocurrency? Want to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'd love to hear from you. And Beth Wendt, welcome back, and I hear it's your birthday, so happy birthday.
Thanks for having me, Larry, and thanks for the birthday wishes. It is my birthday today.
It's great. It's always a fun day, and it's fun to have you with us. I don't know if you're going to be reaching into your cash or your credit card or your check when you buy something, Beth, but we've got other options now, and we can start. Let's talk generally about one of those, the digital wallet. What's the digital wallet?
Well, the digital wallet, I guess, is one less thing to leave your house without. I know. For me personally, I do the phone keys wallet every time I walk out the door in my head, and having one less thing on that list would be really nice. So really what the digital wallet is creating a digital space for your money to be stored to use for transactions, whether it's in a store or online, or even making a payment to a friend. You know, maybe you go out for a meal together and you want to split the bill, and you don't have cash on you to do that. You don't have to put out two credit cards anymore. You can transfer money between folks really easily with many of these different technologies that are available today.
Yeah, well, how common is it to use a digital wallet these days?
Well, I think it's getting to be pretty common amongst younger folks. It's something that people in the generation a little bit younger than me kind of come up using these digital forms of payment because a lot of their shopping experience has been online. So I think they're a little bit more native to the experience of keeping their money in more of a digital environment rather than having physical cash or, plastic credit card or debit card, which, more folks my age and in generations older than me kind of used to having those cash and credit card tangible objects to hold on to. So I think among the younger set, it's really getting popular. And then some folks are coming around to it as they see that it's more secure and more accessible and easy to use.
Yeah. How do you set one up?
So there's a whole lot of different companies out there providing digital wallets. And a couple of the big ones are Apple Pay. And I believe Android has one through Google Pay. And then there are services like PayPal and Venmo, which are a little bit different, but the big ones like Apple Pay essentially set something up through your Apple account that connects to either a credit card or a checking account or a savings account where you have currency stored with a bank. It connects to that account and tracks any purchases that you make through that account. And you can go to a store that has a credit card machine, and most of the new credit card machines now have an Apple Pay option where you just basically scan a QR code on your phone that then debits that amount of money out of your account and keeps a record of that digital transaction. So it's similar to like just walking up and using a debit card, but instead it's using a QR code or a scannable code on your the cell phone screen.
Yeah, and there are other apps out there, as you said, Venmo, you mentioned, Cash App, PayPal, and they're different from the digital wallet.
Yeah, they're a little bit different. You can use them similar to a digital wallet in that you can store money in them. You connect them to a bank account to be able to transfer money into a PayPal or a Venmo account. and then to transfer money out of it back into your bank. But PayPal and Venmo are more used in purchasing things online. So if you're, say you're on Amazon and you want to buy something, you can have money either directly debited from your checking or savings account through PayPal, or you can store money in that PayPal account to pay with. The other thing that's really nice about PayPal and Venmo is it's really easy to transfer funds between your account and someone else's bank account. So like I was mentioning before, you go out for a meal with a friend, you want to split the bill. It's really easy then for one person to pay the other back without having to have cash or write him a check or, you know, catch the next time to buy, pay for the other half of the meal.
I guess the thing that enters a lot of people's minds is security. I mean, if you're sharing your bank account information or personal information with a company like that, how safe is that?
So the issue here is we're trading privacy for convenience, and that's kind of been the standard conundrum online with more convenience. You do have to give up a certain amount of privacy, and you do have to put certain trust in the systems that you're using. So companies like Apple, PayPal, Venmo have been around for a considerable amount of time, are extraordinarily security conscious, would likely be the ones, you know, that I would trust most. But that doesn't guarantee that your data is always secure. So I would say if you're comfortable with online banking, then being comfortable with using one of these major vendors as a digital wallet or a money transfer agent would be a real similar security risk to online banking.
Yeah, it's still nice to use, for me to use my credit card because mm-hmm. I've had a couple of times I've gotten an email or a call from the credit card company saying, did you really charge this necklace or whatever to a place in Arizona? And I said, no. And they said, oh, okay, we'll take care of that.
Yeah, that's the other thing is, you know, there's less protection of the banking system behind you when you're using these digital forms of payment. But then you also have layers of those other vendors that you have to go through if there is a problem. So you're not going directly from your bank to pay. But there is some sort of like inaccuracy or, you know, somebody does happen to make a purchase using your account that's unauthorized. It's going to be a little bit harder to track that down when you're going through multiple vendors to get to the source of where that's coming from.
Let's switch for a minute and talk about cryptocurrency. I know that's something Steve in Reedstown wanted to ask you about. But before we go to Steve, give us an overview of exactly what cryptocurrency is.
Yeah, well, cryptocurrency, I like to think of it as trading money, actual like funds for some sort of a token. So, you know, back in my childhood, we used to go to the arcade, and you couldn't put dollar bills or quarters in the arcade machines. You could only use tokens. So you had to go to the guy selling the tokens or the machine and trade in your dollar bills for tokens that you could put in those arcade machines to play games. So those tokens are now digital. They don't exist physically. They exist in the internet ether using a technology called blockchain. What blockchain is thousands and thousands of computers from all over the world working together, each with a piece of the code that keeps the records of these transactions and aggregating that information to track where the actual money is going from hand to hand. So it's not one central source that's looking at all this information. It's really distributed, which actually adds a large layer of security around the money because it's not centrally managed by one bank. So when you talk about something like Bitcoin, a cryptocurrency, which is really the most popular cryptocurrency and one most people have probably heard of, you are taking your dollars and purchasing these virtual tokens, these Bitcoins, which are each worth a certain number of actual American dollars. I'm not sure what the price is right now, but it fluctuates pretty frequently. It's a pretty volatile currency, so you can't really count on what it's going to cost day to day. But when you buy it, it goes into one of these digital wallets. there are, and it wouldn't go into something like Apple Pay. It would go into a digital wallet like Coinbase. That's probably the largest one out there. They will secure your digital assets, and then you can use those Bitcoins to either purchase things online, or you can sell them as the price rises and falls, just like you would any other commodity or stock or token or currency.
Mm. I think this is a good place to bring Steve in from Reedstown. Steve, thanks for waiting.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on. So the question I have is, when you buy Bitcoin, where does your money actually go? And can you just, once you have the virtual tokens, can you just cash those tokens in and get your actual dollar bills back again? And also, why does it go up and down? My dollars don't go up and down like Bitcoin does. And I've heard that you can even earn money, make on your Bitcoin by doing certain things. How would you be able to, you know, raise value on your cryptocurrency by doing something? This just seems like such a mystery to me that needs to, and I've read articles about it that it shed no light on it whatsoever.
All right.
I think there's a reason. I think there's a reason why they call it cryptocurrency, right? It's so cryptic. It's very hard to grasp this concept of, you know, digital money. And, you know, I've struggled with it myself. A lot of the articles out there are kind of written at such a high level in finance or in technology that it's hard for the layperson to really grasp the concept of what this is. So just to directly answer your question about where does the money go, as I mentioned earlier, when you purchase a cryptocurrency, something like Bitcoin, you would also have an account in either a service like Coinbase, which is a digital wallet for storing that cryptocurrency and then using it for transacting with that cryptocurrency, or you would keep it in the broker so that you have to purchase these through a broker application. You can keep them in the digital wallet through that broker. So you can't just cash them out anytime. The thing with the cryptocurrency is because that the value of those rises and falls with the market, you don't know what that value of that Bitcoin is going to be day to day. So I think back in 2018, one Bitcoin was worth $20,000, whereas a year later, that same Bitcoin was worth $3,200. So very big fluctuation in the value of that Bitcoin. What you would need to do is actually trade that Bitcoin back for the equal dollar value at that time, like you would a stock. So if you're to purchase a stock at $1 a share and you hold on to that stock for 5 years, and the day you want to liquidate that stock asset, you sell it at $5 a share, then your stock value has increased by 500%, and you're going to get five times the amount of dollars back that you initially spent to purchase that stock. It's going to be the same thing with a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin. But it's not just a cash out. It's you actually have to sell that at the current price, like a stock.
Oh, so you're selling it to somebody else who wants to buy Bitcoins.
Yeah, it's like a commodity. The thing with trading in currency, just like if you were trading in dollars or in euros or in yen, is it's kind of a zero-sum game. In order for you to sell it at a higher price than you purchased it for, someone else needs to purchase it for a higher price than they would have. So someone's always on the losing end of that deal.
There you go, Steve. And just, you know, do people try to, you know, he was wondering, how do you get the value to go up after you buy some? People, I imagine.
You wait and you hope.
Yeah.
Yeah. You wait, and a lot of speculators are doing this because, you know, they're speculating that cryptocurrency is going to rise in value. So when it is at a low price, they purchase as much as they can. And then they are speculating on the fact that the value of that purchase is going to go up. When it does, they have to guess that this is the time for me now to sell because it's not going to go up anymore, or I've made as much as I want to, or I don't want to take any more risk, and this is when I'm going to sell. So it's very, very similar to trading stocks, where you're really speculating on the strength of that cryptocurrency. It's not the problem, though, with and the difference between a stock, which has an actual company that is producing something of value behind it. Cryptocurrency is all based on speculation of what that is going to be worth in the future. There is no physical property behind it other than the dollars that someone spent to buy that currency initially. You're not trading in anything physical.
There you go, Steve. Thanks a lot for that call. Appreciate it. Beth Wendt, our guest today, senior IT specialist at the University of Wisconsin Division of Information Technology. Great to have her with us today. Natalie Guyette, our producer, Christina Myshock, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network, taking a look to begin the show at digital wallets, digital currency, cryptocurrency with our guest Beth Wendt, senior IT specialist at the UW's Division of Information Technology. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Jeff in Superior next. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good morning. This is a great topic. What I want to say is from my own experience, I've been with Coinbase for 4 years, and I think of them as a broker. In other words, they own certain cryptocurrencies, which I purchase and trade with them. So I can trade the 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Those values fluctuate, and what I've done, I've accomplished in the 4 years I've done this is, for example, 4 years ago, I purchased 1/10 of a Bitcoin for, I think it was $300 because it was worth $3,000. And then it went up to $15,000 and then I sold it. So I made, you know, $1,500 or whatever, minus whatever I paid. And I currently own about half a dozen different cryptocurrencies, and their values increased, especially with the pandemic last year. Some values went low, and then they shot up really high. So it's a speculative game, like you say. But if you're lucky enough to buy them when they're 6 cents a share, buy 1,000 of them for 6 cents a share, you know, it's only $60. And if it shoots up to $1 a share, you make a lot of money. And I've done that. I don't want to give you the details, but I have bought things for less than 10 cents a share and sold them for over $1 a share. So you can make money doing it, but you're trading with Coinbase and you link it to your bank account. So when you buy a cryptocurrency, it comes out of your bank account. And then when you sell, they just deposit it right in your bank account.
Hmm. Jeff, thanks a lot. Comments, Beth?
Yeah, sounds like a pretty easy way to track all your transactions, to store your Bitcoin or your cryptocurrency, and to broker those transactions. I haven't personally used Coinbase because I don't trade with cryptocurrencies, but that is really the one that I've heard most about and read most about. It seems to be the most popular one out there, easy to use and pretty accessible for folks. And impressed, Jeff, with your ability to make some money on these cryptocurrency markets. It's definitely a bit of a gamble, but some folks are doing well at it.
Yeah, Jeff, thank you again. Appreciate that experience, sharing your experiences with us. Mark in Cross Plains, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Mark.
Hi. The question of money, I think, is actually separate from this business of digital commodities, because whether you're buying and selling gold, or you're buying and selling other commodities, or you're buying and selling these digital currencies, those are just commodities. And it's not really addressing the question of the instability that exists in the system that we call money. But if the monetary unit has a cost associated with its existence or with its use, then the instability that we see is not going to be helped, or it's actually going to be either unchanged or exacerbated by thinking that a digital commodity is going to somehow bring stability to the question of money. It's presently unstable and has been unstable because we're actually assigning cost to the existence and the use of the monetary unit. So this question of monetary stability isn't ever going to be facilitated or addressed or remedied by the use of digital commodity type money. And a way to address that would be to look at the question of assigning cost to the existence and use of the monetary unit, the dollar, or the euro or whatever the monetary unit happens to be where you are. And unless that is abandoned, the instability that we have from the system never goes away. So you could look at a website called bibocurrency.com, and that it's explained much more fully at that website, bibocurrency.com.
Well, Mark, thank you for calling. Comments, Beth?
Well, I'm a little bit out of my depth in talking about currency stability and the financial markets. You know, my trade is IT, but I don't see in the future cryptocurrency really taking any more of a role in our global economy than it is, just because there are no physical assets really backing it up. What seems to be a kind of more of a long-term kind of stick-around part of our economy is the technology behind cryptocurrency, which is that blockchain and the distributed manner in which transactions are going to be processed and stored.
Yeah, Mark, thank you so much for calling. Tom emailed with a question. He's wondering if Apple Pay has to use an Apple credit card. Can he use his MasterCard?
Well, you should be able to use any card or account with Apple Pay. You just have to link it either to a debit card, a credit card, or an active bank account. Any one of those three should work.
Okay. And Tina from Green Bay called because her teenage son has been interested in mining cryptocurrency for a few years. He's been interested, but she's concerned about whether or not it's safe to do on a home Wi-Fi network. She understands that you can either buy a miner or do it yourself with a high-powered graphics card. Mm-hmm. What do you think? And I think this is to begin with, we need to explain what she's talking about here with mining cryptocurrency.
Yeah, mining cryptocurrency, it's kind of a cute term, calling it mining. What that means, so I've talked a little bit about this today. There is a large network of computers out there that is doing all of this computational work on the storing of digital funds, the encryption of those digital wallets so that they are secure, and processing the transactions between cryptocurrency vendors and digital wallets. So that takes a whole lot of computing power to do it. You know, traditionally we had tens of thousands of banks around the world doing all of this work in some manual way. Now it's all being done by distributed computers all over the world. And no one organization owns all of those machines. They're actually individual machines that individual people own. And they they sign up for an application that allows them to join that network of computers doing all of that processing. Now, what that does is allows you to use your own machine to add to that blockchain technology that I'm talking about for the encryption and the transaction processing. And as part of that blockchain, they're using your computer's resources to do all of that work behind the scenes. The problem with that is it's very, very resource intensive. It uses a lot of electricity. It uses a lot of computing power. You're not going to really be able to do much else with that computer while it's doing Bitcoin mining because it's going to be using all of its resources for that transactional work. I actually just read an article recently saying that Bitcoin mining right now is now consuming more power than the country of Argentina. So think about how much of our resources we're using in order to create this digital currency and manage this digital currency. I think if you started doing some Bitcoining mining right now, you'd probably see your electric bill skyrocket and you wouldn't really make a whole lot doing it. So the money comes in becoming a Bitcoin miner as you become part of this blockchain. The more and more of your resources you provide to that system, you are then entitled to be paid in Bitcoin for those resources. But it takes a whole lot of work and a whole lot of time and a whole lot of computing power to actually make it worth your while.
There you go, Tina. You may want to reconsider or explain a little more to your son, your teenage son, about this if you perhaps don't want your electric bill to go skyrocket. You can join in too. And by the way, we can take other questions as well. We don't have to stay with cryptocurrency or wallets and that sort of thing. If you have a question, I hope you'll join in just about your computer, some issue it's having, fine, or maybe just a question. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@WPR.org. Ron in La Crosse up next. Ron, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I have a question. The bank where I have a couple of accounts, checking accounts, wants me to go with electronic statements rather than send a printed statement through the snail mail. But I'm a little leery going online with that, and I was wondering if your guests would know if it would help ensure my privacy if I subscribe to a virtual private network like Norton LifeLock advertises on TV.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of difference between just going with electronic statements and doing full online banking. So it sounds like your bank is asking you to go paperless, which a lot of banks are trying to do right now, one, to save them money because they don't have to mail something to you every month, and two, for environmental purposes, you know, let's use less paper in our lives if we can. The electronic statements would basically be your bank sending you an email message every month with a statement of your banking activity. Now, usually they don't attach that statement. They would send a link in that email that would then log you into their electronic banking website to allow you to view that statement online rather than having a piece of paper sent to you every month. So it's getting you closer to that full service online banking because then you'll be logging into something online to actually read that message and to look at your statements. If you're going to be going into like full online banking where you want to be doing transactions through your online banking app, and you want to know that you have some sense of security, a VPN is not a bad way to go. And just for general online security in general, VPN is something that's going to give you some peace of mind. It means you have this encrypted internet tunnel coming from your internet connection out into the world. The issue that you may run into is if you're on public networks using a VPN, sometimes it can cause problems. So if you're like out in a coffee shop and trying to use your phone and it's got a VPN application on it, it could interfere with the Wi-Fi. But I also wouldn't recommend doing online banking on a public network anyway. So hope that answers your question, Ron.
Yeah, thank you, Ron, for calling. Good luck. Appreciate it. I think it can be safe for sure. Michael in Bear Valley, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Michael.
Hello. Yeah, I just have a question about Bitcoin security. My son was dabbling in Bitcoins, and over a period of years, he started telling me about how much money he was making. And then one day, not too distant past, I asked him how he was doing, and he said that he'd gone online to count his Bitcoins, and they were all gone. And so I'm just wondering, is this kind of like funny money? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's not the only one, by the way, Michael. You want to comment, Beth?
Yeah, it definitely is not funny money. It's because those Bitcoins were purchased with real money. So if they're gone, the money that was used to purchase them is also gone. And, you know, you no longer have that value. So the real important part with a cryptocurrency wallet is the password. If you lose the password to your cryptocurrency wallet, you cannot recover it. No one else can get it back for you. That account is encrypted and locked. There is no way to get into it without that key. So if you don't have that password for the encryption key, you're going to lose what's in your wallet. And I was reading an article again recently about how much money right now is in locked cryptocurrency wallets that people can't get access to. Millions and millions of dollars sitting there that folks can't get at. So, you know, that's definitely one concern with using something like that is it's not a physical asset that you can put in a safe in your house and know that it's there. As far as it disappearing, that is news to me. Because of the encryption chains that they're using for cryptocurrency wallets, having that money looted, it would be a really rare occurrence, I think, outside of somebody figuring out what your password is or having shared your password with somebody or something like that. So I would wonder how that would happen.
Well, if somebody, if you have to, you've got to have it somewhere.
Yeah.
And so, and can you use something like LastPass?
Yeah, I mean, that's also always a good idea for password security to use something like that. Now, I would say somebody could have gotten a hold of the password by some other means, you know, hacking the computer the person was using, using a keylogger to, you know, log their keystrokes while they were logging into their account. You know, some sort of man-in-the-middle attack could be used to capture that information. But the encryption around those applications is some of the strongest out there outside of military technology. So it's quite trustworthy.
All right, Michael, I'm sorry to hear about your son's problem, but there you go. Mike in Sun Prairie, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I've got an old computer, maybe 10 years old, the box, you know. And I try and keep up on the maintenance, you know, and deleting things and that sort of thing. And it seems like there's a fair number of these sites that it runs so slow, it loads up slow and all that. Is it the computer or is it just that I'm on a busy site or what?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's likely that if it's not everything that's running slow, just certain sites, those websites that you're going to may be using some sort of back-end technology that your computer's struggling with. So I know that if it's doing any kind of like streaming video or if there's complicated graphics on the site or if it's trying to load a lot of data at one time, your computer may be churning pretty hard on all of that. You know, if, even if our hardware, our computer hardware is perfectly maintained and you don't think 10 years is that old for something, the software behind a lot of the web technology out there, a lot of the internet stuff that we're interacting with is changing so quickly that 10-year-old hardware is really going to struggle to keep up with processing that type of information. So it may be that your computer is really just aging out of being useful in a lot of the modern websites that we're using now.
Yeah, that could well be. 10 years is a long time in a computer's life anymore, yeah. Unfortunately. Well, thanks for calling, Mike. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us at ideas@WPR.org. ideas@WPR.org. There's been one specific kind of cryptocurrency in the news lately, the non-fungible tokens, or NFTs. And there's a lot of money flowing back and forth on those. What exactly are we talking about here?
Oh, these are so cool, Larry. It's right up my alley because I'm very passionate about art and also technology, and this is the kind of the convergence of those two things, art and technology. So non-fungible tokens. A good way to think of those is an unreproducible piece of artwork. So it is a digital piece of artwork that has code behind it that is encrypted and cannot be reproduced. So you can look at this image, and it's, you know, readable by certain technologies as being known as the only one of these things out there. So some digital artist can create a beautiful digital image or even just an emoji or something funky, and you can purchase that token, and it is the only one in existence like it. And this is a thing now because I guess, I don't know, maybe folks are running out of stuff to collect. you know,
I know. I saw a New York Times. Natalie Guyette, our producer, gave me a copy of a New York Times tech column on this. And these works of digital art are going for thousands and thousands of dollars.
Yeah, it's a really amazing way for digital artists to have a platform for selling their artwork. You know, these days it's really hard to get your artwork known. There's especially digital artwork. There's so much of it out there in the ether. And if you're not a known artist, if you don't have a large online following, it's really hard to get your artwork out there and to have it viewed by a large number of people so that you can actually sell some work and support yourself as an artist. And these NFTs, or non-fungible tokens, are a way for artists to really realize some of the value in their unique artworks. If they can create a unique piece of digital artwork that somebody sees value in and is willing to pay for, and it is a one-of-a-kind piece, it doesn't matter that it's not a tangible thing that you can hold in your hands anymore to folks. They can see it online, and it's the only one. Now, somebody can take a screenshot of it, and they have that same picture, but it doesn't have the code behind it telling that person that it is the one-of-a-kind. So it's basically like taking a reproduction of a painting. You know, you've got the Mona Lisa that is worth, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars because it is the original one, and it can be verified as such. And there are, you know, thousands of copies out there that are worth nothing.
Beth Wendt, our guest today. Mark in Nina, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I have a question. I mean, I have Norton. One of the previous guests mentioned the VPN from Norton, and I have the VPN, and I have it on my home computer and on my phone. And I'm not absolutely sure if this happens on my home computer, but on my phone, when you type in a product, and it shows those little previews that are like shopping previews, you know, then you click on them, and it doesn't allow you to go there. And I think it has to do with Google Lead Services. I think that's the thing that comes up, and it just is stymied there.
Hmm. Beth, a comment?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I haven't used the Norton product for VPN. So, I think likely what you'll have to do is there's usually settings in your VPN software that allow you to unblock certain websites by their address. And if you're having trouble with Google Lead coming through when your VPN is on, likely what you'd need to do is go into the settings of that VPN, and usually there's something called a whitelist or an always allow or an unblock section where you can go in and put the website that isn't coming through in that list of allowed sites, and it'll no longer block that through your VPN.
That makes sense. Mark, good luck. Thank you so much. Karen in Galena, Illinois, your turn.
Yes, hi. Along the lines of the bank statement security, I oftentimes wonder about my financial planner. Like, all my investments are with, let's say, Edward Jones. And I'm concerned because I do the online statements, and with all the hacking that's going on with companies getting hacked left and right, how secure is that? Like, could somebody hack it and then just for giggles erase everything, and then I don't have my money, like it evaporates?
Yeah. Beth?
Yeah, I definitely could see the anxiety in that. So a couple of things. Generally, when you know, you've got a large financial institution that's managing investments, they've got pretty high security walls around all of that data. Now, but there are breaches that happen, as you're reading the news, frequently. Generally, when those breaches happen, the malicious actors who are doing that are taking large dumps of information from these companies. So they're taking personal information about the folks who are invested with that organization. So they're getting names, addresses, social security numbers, birth dates, account numbers, all of that type of information, and then putting together a picture of individuals to be able to use that to either steal identity or access bank accounts and transfer funds, things like that. So there is a real concern with when that information gets into the wrong hands, that it could be used to take your money from you. It could be used to actually, you know, do something within the financial institution's infrastructure to scramble their data, to erase their data, to steal the data, to make it so that those transactions aren't visible. I haven't heard of something like that happening to the point where data has been locked or money has been lost by a large financial institution, but it certainly is in the realm of possibility. And one of the things I absolutely recommend for folks who have anxieties about that is to sign up with one of these identity protection organizations. So LifeLock is one that is really reputable and affordable. They do credit monitoring. They do identity theft monitoring, and they will watch out for you if there is anything with any of the accounts that you maintain that is reported as a breach. They will alert you immediately. You can then take whatever action you feel is necessary to ensure your money is safe. And if any of your data is compromised in any of the organizations that you stored data with, LifeLock will let you know that that's happening. And they also give you protection up to a certain dollar amount if you do lose money because of a breach. So it's kind of an insurance policy.
Yeah, it is indeed. Karen, thank you for calling. Beth Wendt, our guest today, IT specialist with UW's Division of Information Technology. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. I did want to mention, before we go back to talking cryptocurrency and other issues, that we have a new blog on the website. You can go to the WPR.org/Larry. And there's a story about the Wisconsin author who's written the book Raft of Stars. It's a great book. And Andrew Graff's the author. And the story is about how Wisconsin's North Woods takes a central role in the novel A Raft of Stars. So I hope you'll take a look at our blog for a look at that. We may have a story at some point about cryptocurrency. Who knows? That could be one of the stories as we visit with Beth Wendt on the show today. You can join in with your questions. Doesn't have to be about cryptocurrency. It could be about any other kind of issue you're having with your computer or with your phone. Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@WPR.org. John in Fox Point emailed with a question about digital wallets. He has a flip phone, not a smartphone, but it can connect to the internet if he wants to. He's wondering if he can use Apple or Google Pay for his flip phone.
Unfortunately not. No, you have to be able to download an application to your phone to be able to use Apple Pay or Google Pay, one of those applications for paying in a store. And flip phones just don't have that capacity at this point. So if you do want to be able to use it, I would recommend going with a smartphone. The other applications we're talking about, things like Coinbase and Venmo and PayPal, those can all be used on a computer. As well as on a phone. So if you wanted to start dabbling in those and you have a computer at home, that's something you could maybe check out first if you don't want to jump right to a smartphone.
Yep. Jim in Cedarburg brought up ETFs or exchange-traded funds. And someone else brought that up. And Jim in Cedarburg is wondering if you could talk a bit more about why someone would be interested in this.
An ETF.
Yeah.
So that's, again, a little bit out of my depth because that's more in the financial sector than in the IT world. But what I do know about those exchange-traded funds is that they're really similar to a mutual fund. It is an aggregation of stocks or commodities or any other asset that's put together into a traded fund. The main difference between ETFs and a mutual fund is they trade all day long. So there's thousands of trades that go on those all day long, so the price rises and falls you know, many times a day. Those will change really dynamically, whereas a mutual fund is only traded once a day, so the price only changes once a day on those. But that's really all I know about ETFs.
A listener emailed a few things they've learned about mining and the creation of bitcoins. They say that a large percentage of the mining is done on hijacked computers or illegally backing into people's computers to do so. They also say mining of Bitcoin does use a lot of electricity. I think you'd know if somebody backed into your computer just by your electric bill, Beth.
I think, and you might also by how much you can't use your computer for anything else. But, you know, it may be why we get some callers telling us that their computers are really slow. If somebody has hijacked their machine and is trying to use it for Bitcoin, that could be a reason. Generally, you would know something's wrong. Because everything would slow down to a crawl. You really wouldn't be able to do much else. But I think this happens a lot with folks who don't use their machines much. You know, if they just sit there, they're powered on, they're not being used for much else but email and web browsing, and people might not notice that they're running kind of slow. And often that is when a machine gets hijacked and they're taking over the resources of your computer, those are being used for something like mining Bitcoin. That is a big moneymaker for folks. So when they're not being used for spamming everyone, then they're likely being used for mining Bitcoin.
Tom in Waukesha, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning. I'm calling with regard to the caller that called in about hacking of large investment firms' files. Obviously, many of us have monies that are managed by large investment firms. And isn't it true that this is where the good old paper statement is important to keep in your files? Because if this does happen, you can bring that out and say, hey, 3 months ago, I had XYZ and it was worth $100,000. So don't tell me my money's gone. Isn't that true?
Well, I can't tell you how many times having a piece of paper in hand has saved me from other circumstances like that. Well, it hasn't happened with financial institutions losing money or telling you something different. It does give you that peace of mind knowing that you have a statement from the bank giving you exactly, you know, a reference of what you had and what you have. So a lot of people like to have that peace of mind, and I don't blame them. Personally, I try to keep paper copies of what I feel is important, but there are some times when I wish that I kept that piece of paper and I didn't have it. So I would say if that makes you feel more comfortable with using a financial institution that you know, may or may not have any security issue, I would say go for it. Keep those.
Yeah, and since we're talking about money and technology, there are also apps out there that help us advise us on investments or help save on budget, you know, budgeting our money and so forth. What do you know about those personal finance apps?
Well, I need one that, like, zaps me every time I go to buy something I shouldn't. you know, it'd be nice if that was a feature. You know, it gives you a little zap on your phone or something every time you go to, you know, buy a $4 coffee that you shouldn't buy. But there are so many options out there for financial applications that you can either use on your cell phone, on your smartphone, or on your computer for tracking your purchases, your all of your accounts, and for budgeting and you know, maintaining investments. You can actually put those all in a single application now and just keep track of all of your assets in one place. Couple of different ones that I've used. A big one is Quicken. A lot of folks like to use Quicken. It's one that you would need to pay for. It's not a free app, but it is one of those where you can just store all of your financial information, and it's really comprehensive. It's been around for decades, and it's a pretty powerful piece of software. It can interface directly with your banks, so you can connect it to your accounts so it can live track your transactions. It has an online component, so you can use it, you know, remotely. You don't have to be sitting at your computer to do it. It allows you to do budgeting. There's another one out there called Mint it's a free one. That's a great budgeting application that does also connect to your bank accounts and does live tracking of your transactions, things like that. It'll send you alerts if you're over a budget amount on something. So let's say I budget X number of dollars for my entertainment for the month, and I went to too many movies, and I go to a movie and I go over my budget, it's going to, you know, kind of give me that zap. It's going to give me an alert saying, hey, you're $25 over your entertainment budget for the month. Stop spending money. So I find that those are really helpful for keeping me on track.
Yeah, maybe I should get my hands on one of those.
Now, if I could only get my kids to keep track on those of how much of my money they're spending.
Understand completely. Oh, boy. Beth Wendt, our guest today, information technologist with the UW Division of Information Technology. She's been doing this for 20 years or so she knows a lot. And you can join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with Beth Wendt. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking with Beth Wendt on the show today, Senior IT Specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, 20 years of tech experience. Are you having problems with your computer, your printer, or other technology? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Again, love to hear from you. Dean in Sussex, Wisconsin, we'll give you a chance now. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I was listening to your guest, and she was talking about Bitcoin and the Bitcoin mining and the high energy usage of it. And so I was actually on my ride to work, and I'm here now. But so my thought about the whole thing is kind of with all these different types of coins out there and what their value really is. And I'm very new to this myself. I've just been researching it, but I have heavily for about 2 months now. And I agree that, you know, we are all trying to take better care of the earth that God has given us. And it does use a lot of energy, Bitcoin does. And so there's a new product. Well, I won't say it's new. I think in 2013 it came out. It's XRP, which is known as an altcoin. And so Bitcoin, as far as value goes, as far as I understand it, it's more of a trading thing, which it's a usage, but does not, yeah, it doesn't really hold any value. Where this XRP, it has utility, it has value, and it's because of the system that it is. It's about transferring money. The money transfers can be done in from 3 to 5 seconds, and the cost behind it is like 1/100th of a cent. And there are other coins like Ethereum, which depending on how much money is transferred, the charge for that can be as much as $50, and they call them gas fees. So I myself am investing in XRP. I think it's at one point was number 3 ranked in these coins. And it's part of it's called the quantum financial system. And I think this is something that is really going to take over. The way I see it, it's kind of like Henry Ford. He invented gave us a gasoline engine. And obviously there was room for improvement where we're at today with fuel injection and all the other different things that the motor has come a long ways. And I think that, and this is just my opinion, I think Bitcoin is actually probably going to be a thing of the past because of the energy usage and, and it was kind of more of a prototype for this whole thing. It was the first coin. I mean, Bitcoin was the first coin, but I think the tables are going to start turning to a more green earth system.
You know what? Thanks, Dean, for calling. Appreciate it. Are you familiar with that system, Beth?
A traded token that is, you know, purchased with, you know, other currency. And like I was talking about earlier, the what I think is going to be the lasting change in financial markets isn't the actual cryptocurrencies themselves, but those blockchain technologies for processing those digital transactions. And I think that's maybe what Dean was alluding to, is that XRP and the processing that they're using in order to produce their coin may be a bit more efficient and doesn't have the power overhead that Bitcoin does. And maybe as these Bitcoin producers or companies become more aware of their footprint, that they're going to become more popular than some of the earlier players that weren't as conscious of that.
Yeah, makes sense. Dean, thank you. Rose in Madison, your turn. Hi, Rose.
Hi. I've had problems downloading my Windows 10 updates, and so I thought my software, McAfee software, should be removed by advice from somebody else. And when I was trying to remove it, I accidentally clicked on another thing, and then I uninstalled Windows module, and I can't remember what the next word is. I couldn't get it to go back on my computer doing the Windows restore thing that you can do, where they tell you how to do it. But I'm wondering if your guest has any advice for me on how to do that. And it's not in my trash bin.
It's not?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, usually when you uninstall an application, it's not going to go into the trash file. So that's really only for separate, you know, individual files that you delete. When you delete an application or a program from Windows, usually you go through the control panel, and there's something in there that's an add remove programs or programs and software, where you can go in and see everything that's actually installed on your computer, and then you can choose to install or uninstall things or repair them if they're not working properly. So if that's where you uninstalled that from, Rose, it wouldn't show up in your trash. But likely it's something that you can download and reinstall if you know the name of it. So with the first two words, Windows module or Windows modular, I'm not sure exactly what that is, but I would run a Google search on those two words, Windows module or Windows modular, and Windows 10, or Windows module reinstall, or Windows modular download, and see if you can go to Microsoft's site and re-download that application and then run the installer file that you download, and that should put it back into your programs.
That's a good idea. Good luck, Rose. Thank you very much for calling. Annette in Green Bay will give you a chance. Hi, Annette.
Yeah, hi, Larry and guest. I have a question about VPN, Virtual Protocol Network, I think. And is that something for a private person to have, or is that more of a corporate and remote working thing? And is it more secure than a regular internet provider? And I've seen it advertised like 10 different companies on PC Magazine. Can you just talk about that a little bit, please?
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So you were close. It's Virtual Private Network is what VPN stands for, but you're really close to that one. What that is essentially a secure tunnel. So when we think about this in physical terms, when you are using a piece of VPN software, it is creating an enclosed tunnel around the internet traffic that you are sending and receiving from your device. So if you're on your cell phone or on your computer, either one of those can have a VPN on it. When you log in via your VPN, you sign into it with a secure password, and that connects to the internet using this tunnel. Essentially, it is creating a barrier around all of those bits and bytes that you're sending through that internet connection, whether it's financial data, personal data, streaming video, whatever you're doing on the internet is now encapsulated in this encrypted tunnel, so that anyone on the outside who might be trying to capture any data that's being transmitted or received from your computer isn't going to be able to get in to see that data. We call that data in transit. So anything that is being sent or received from your machine is data in transit. And that data that's being transmitted across those lines that carry all of our internet traffic can be vulnerable. And there are ways of compromising those lines that carry our internet traffic in order to steal information, to compromise information, to corrupt information. And that's happening all the time. So using one of those VPNs is a way to privately secure your data specifically as it travels across the internet to wherever you're trying to connect to. It's newer for individuals to be using these. That's not something that was generally in the public eye until the last maybe 4 or 5 years. They were mostly used by companies who had remote workers who needed to be able to connect into company data from outside of the physical office. Now they're becoming much more popular amongst individual users who want to secure their data when they're doing online banking or things where they're afraid that certain sensitive data might be compromised. So I would recommend them. There's tons of companies offering them. Most of the actual companies that you're getting your antivirus or your web security software from, like Norton and McAfee, also have VPN software that's very reputable. So I would recommend going with one of the bigger players on that.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much, Annette, for calling. John in Elgin, Illinois, emailed to ask about security on an iPad. He uses his iPad for online banking and investing transactions, but doesn't have any type of security software such as Norton, which he used on his old PC and laptop. Is there anything like that for the iPad?
There is, yes. And it's funny, it used to be that there weren't a lot of security tools made for Apple products, and it was because they were less vulnerable. A lot fewer viruses were being written for Apple products up until maybe 5, 6 years ago. And now they're catching up. So your Apple products are not more secure than your Windows products anymore or your Android products anymore. And a lot of the vendors who are producing those security software packages have caught up and are now making versions for iPads and iPhones and all of those different devices. So McAfee, Norton, all of those players do have options available for an iPad or an iPhone. I would highly recommend purchasing one. There are tools built into the iOS, the operating system that's on your iPad. But they're going to be pretty basic, and those are kind of the first ones to get compromised are those that are built into operating systems. So I would go with a third-party tool.
And you need to be careful. I wouldn't go whole hog and get two or three. I would have one and stay with the one because I know there are problems. Yeah, they don't play well together.
No, they don't. You definitely don't want to put two different antivirus softwares on one machine. They're going to fight with each other.
Yeah. Carolyn emailed to say her laptop tells her in the morning when she boots it up that this network isn't secure. It uses an older security standard that is being phased out. She wants to know if her provider should be doing something to make it more secure.
Yeah, that's actually likely your internet router telling you that your network is using an insecure protocol or an old security standard. Guessing that it's your Wi-Fi encryption that is needs to be updated. There are several different types of security on a Wi-Fi router. There's an older security model called WEP encryption. I believe that's the one that's being phased out in favor of a much more secure protocol. But I doubt that you're going to want to dig into your router to change that yourself. What you might want to do is give your internet service provider a call if they are the ones who you got your router from. And their help desk will be able to walk you through the security settings on that router to change it over to the new security protocol so that you've got a more secure network set up.
Yeah. Tina from Green Bay called back. She had asked about her home network and mining cryptocurrency from her house, and she wanted to know as well if her house network is at risk if she lets her son make crypto currency mining from their house.
Yeah. So I don't think that it would necessarily change your security profile of your network. But what it does do is if you're going to be mining cryptocurrency, that computer is going to be on and running constantly. It's not going to be shut down ever. So you're going to have this open window, essentially, that's never turned off. And leaving your computer on and running all the time, depending on how diligent you are about security on that computer, could be like leaving the window to your house open. So I would say if you're going to be mining cryptocurrency, make sure that you have some pretty sensible security software running on your machine that's always kept up to date.
All right. Linda emailed with a clarifying question related to financial statements. She says, even if you get your financial statements in paper form, if your company is breached, the hackers would still get your private information, correct?
That is true. If there is a breach at your financial institution and the person who breaches that institution is able to get to their files for their customers, they may be able to compromise personal information from you. So that's, again, another reason to subscribe to one of the credit monitoring services that's going to keep an eye on your data and make sure that if there is a compromise that you know about it and you can do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Somebody else was wondering about the NFTs or the non-fungible tokens we were talking about earlier. You know, some people like to collect baseball cards or vintage glassware. And this person was wondering if NFTs are another form of collecting.
100% they are. That's really exactly what they are. It's similar to collecting art. It's just in digital form rather than physical form. So someone's creating a unique piece of creative work, and other folks are paying for it, whatever value they assign to that piece of work. So I guess something is only as valuable as someone is willing to pay for it. And it seems that these non-fungible tokens are kind of the latest collectible that folks can own and brag about. And I know people collect everything from sneakers to dolls to stamps to everything in between, action figures and comic books. And this is just a new collectible.
And you can hang these on your wall or do whatever you want with them, right?
Well, it's not necessarily something you can hang on the wall because it's digital, but you can make it your avatar. That's what a lot of folks do, you know, for their bragging rights. They can say this is a one of a kind, no one else can have it, and their digital presence has this, you know, beautiful piece of artwork associated with it.
Susan in Madison, thank you for calling. What's on your mind? Susan, are you there?
Oh, yes. Hi. Thank you. I appreciate your guest. So I got a new phone and a new phone number, but I've been getting quite a few texts calls to the previous owner of the phone number. Is that just real common, or is there some AT&T network I should check up on? My cousin said when I called her, it came through somebody else's name. So,
really? Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I would definitely check with your phone provider on that. They are supposed to, usually once a number is relinquished, they're supposed to hold that number for an amount of time before it's given out to another person. So it may be that something got messed up within their provisioning system where you got a number that was released too early. And they do that to avoid this kind of problem where somebody gives up a number and it's assigned to someone else right away, and suddenly you're getting calls for someone you have no idea who they are. So I would reach out to AT&T and tell them that this is happening, and they should be able to fix this for you.
All right. There you go, Susan. It's a good idea. I'd check that out right away for sure. And let's see. We've got some other callers coming on, but those apps that we were talking about earlier, money and technology, you know, advising you, are those safe to use? Somebody else wondered.
So, again, I'm going to say it's you want to do your research before you jump into one. You want to read about, you know, who is doing what regarding security. I wouldn't go with any of the managers that have reported a breach recently. Obviously, you don't want to go with someone who's already got lax security. You know, there's a lot of information out there. You just need to, you know, spend a little bit of time doing research to figure out, you know, which one you're most comfortable with. And then there's always that risk-reward push-pull. Is it worth the risk for the reward you get? And is it worth compromising a little bit of your privacy in order to get the convenience?
Steve in Fort Atkinson, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Say, I have a question. One of my questions was already answered, but I have another one. I have an external hard drive on my computer, and I keep a lot of pictures and information on there. Say, it's in my G drive, so when I go into my my folders and go into my G drive, well, before I get into my G drive, there's icons on the side. And then there will be my G drive and will be another thing called libraries, and that has a G drive in it also. Just wondering if that's a duplicate of what I have, if I have twice as much stuff on that hard drive. You know, I kind of wanted to delete that out of the libraries, but I was afraid I'd delete everything. I don't know if it's a duplicate.
Yeah, that library folder, it wouldn't be a duplicate. It's generally just shortcuts to where the files are stored. So that's Windows trying to give you easier ways to access data that you've got stored. And, you know, some people store things all over the place. They don't just keep it in their My Documents folder. They've got it in their, you know, their Photos folder, and they've got things all in different places. And those libraries folders are really just shortcuts showing you where your data is. So it's not a duplication of what's already there.
All right, there we go. Well, this has been a lot of fun. Are you going to sell any artwork on through your non-fungible tokens?
No, I've been thinking about it. Most of the art I do is physical artwork. I don't do a lot of digital artwork anymore, but I've been thinking about taking some of my images and maybe digitizing them, putting them up there to see if anybody wants to buy them. We'll see.
Well, keep me informed.
I will.
Thanks, and thanks a lot for calling and for being with us today. I really appreciate it, Beth. Always a pleasure. Yeah. We'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. Have a great day.
You as well, and happy birthday again. Beth Wendt, working in IT for 20 years. She's a senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. She loves to find creative solutions to problems. Well, tomorrow on the show, we talk about your health. First up, we learn how to approach end-of-life planning just in time for National Healthcare Decision Day on Friday, April 16th. And then at 11:45, we'll hear from a UW health oncologist about her research on why many female lung cancer patients also experience challenges with sexual health. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.